This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
In the early morning hours of Valentine's Day 1995, the Pittsburgh Fire Department responded to a blaze on Briceland Street. Darlene Buckner and her teenage son Greg Brown joined their safely evacuated family members as the raging inferno took the lives of three firefighters. ATF investigators suspected arson, and a lab tech reported that two of the 13 samples from the home were positive for gasoline. However, a gas-powered mower stored in the basement may have been the source. Reward money brought forth two alleged witnesses to confirm what investigators had suspected, that Darlene Buckner and Greg Brown intentionally set the blaze to collect on the $20,000 insurance policy, a dollar amount that must have been incentive enough to destroy all their possessions and the lives of three brave firefighters. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I hate wrongful convictions. I hate every one of the cases that we've covered, and for different reasons. But there's a particular thing that keeps me up at night, which are cases like the one that we're going to talk about today, where someone was wrongfully convicted of a crime that never even happened. Today, we're going to be talking with Greg Brown, who served 20 years in Pennsylvania for an accidental fire. A tragic fire, nonetheless. Three lives were lost, but there was a rush to judgment. There was junk science. There was all sorts of other things that you're going to hear about. And we've covered arson in our junk science podcast. But first, I want to introduce Elizabeth DeLosa from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Elizabeth, I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for all the incredible work that you and the team there do. And of course, now I get the privilege of interviewing a man I first met in Phoenix at the Innocence Network Conference, Greg Brown. Greg, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go back to simpler times before 1995, Valentine's Day, when this horrible event happened. What was it like? Did you grow up in Pittsburgh? And what was your life like? Did you have brothers and sisters? Did you have a happy childhood?
Yes. Yeah, I grew up in Pittsburgh. You know, my mom was a single mother until about the age of 7. And she met my stepfather. I have a stepsister that's 2 years older than me, and a stepbrother that's about 4 years older than me. So it was a nice blended family. And my mom didn't have another child until 1993. So it was happy, man. My stepdad was great. Good father figure, great provider, good guy, straight laced, everything by the book, you know, never break a law. It was good. I had a good upbringing.
So you were a typical teenager, just 17 years old, when this tragic fire happened on the night of February 13th into the 14th of 1995.
The next day was obviously, it was Valentine's Day. So I was excited. My school was going to have a dance, you know. So I like that night. I was over my one of my older cousins' house playing Madden like the kids do now on the Sega Genesis. And my stepfather said, go to the store with mom because it's dark out there, whatever. And my mom was cooking for a relative had died. So she was cooking for like a funeral, a repast. And we went to Giant Eagles, one location on the east side near our house. And it was closed. So we went to Waterworks. We come home on Frankstown Avenue. You could look over and see the houses. And we seen fire trucks. And like, man, mom, that look like our house. And we pulled into the alleyway in between Frankstown and Bryceland. And we were anxious. We wanted to know if our family was out. And one of the firemen was on the back porch. Said, yeah, they're out. They're across the street at the neighbor's house. And my mom was frantic. The firemen just wanted her to get the car out the alleyway, you know, because there's probably going to be more fire trucks coming. And she had to drive around. You know, we seen our family. We just was ecstatic, just happy that everybody was out. You know, now it's a waiting game, and you're hoping they put the fire out as soon as possible. And maybe you could get whatever you can out of the house. And the more time it goes on, it's obvious that the house is going to get destroyed. And I went over to one of the firemen, and I said, this fire's over. They said, yeah, but we lost three of our guys. I'm like, what? They said, yeah, three firemen died. I'm like, man. You know, and then one of them said, like, I believe it was the furnace. I went back and told my family, like, man, they said three firemen died. And my mom just broke down, started crying, and everybody, we was just in shock.
The city of Pittsburgh lost three courageous firefighters, Thomas Brooks, Patty Conroy, and Mark Calenda. So rest in peace. I can't imagine how that news must have shaken their families and the entire community.
No, this case in Pittsburgh was extremely, and still is, highly publicized. And there was no way for anyone to move on, including now. Anything arson related to this day, a lot of times this case will come up, but this case was always on the news.
So you can imagine the rush to judgment to figure out what went wrong here. And often when a death is hard to accept, like in the case of a child or baby or men and women in uniform, we sometimes see that same urge to blame somebody, even when there's no one to blame.
In investigating several arson cases here in Western Pennsylvania, I think one common denominator is a very quick rush to judgment and determining within hours that the fire is intentionally set, thereby being a crime, being arson, without having done the painstaking investigation that it takes in order to rule out all accidental causes. And Greg's case is no different. 911 calls first came in around 12:20 a.m. on the 14th. And by 3 a.m., the Pittsburgh Fire Squad, Pittsburgh Police, knew that they had firefighter fatalities and called in the ATF in order to assist in the investigation. And within hours and upon visual inspection alone, it was determined that this fire had been intentionally set, and that set those criminal investigation gears into motion. And then once they were started, it seems like there was no stopping them.
So the visual inspection, also known as the junk science portion of the investigation, in which they used disproven fire investigation methods using terms like alligator burn patterns or crazed glass, etc. You can hear all about this, by the way, and I encourage you to check it out in our coverage of arson investigation on our series Junk Science, which will be linked in the episode description. So in an effort to corroborate that assessment with actual science, they sent 13 samples from the basement, which they believed was the fire's origin point. They sent those samples for testing, and eventually the lab tech said that two of the 13 samples tested positive for gasoline. But there also appears to be a perfectly logical explanation for that.
I want to just back up a little bit because, so you're right, 13 samples are taken, and the ATF believes that a gallon of gasoline is poured onto a pile of laundry that is in the basement, and that is what the origin of the fire is, right? So they, during the fire suppression efforts, the basement is flooded. There's about a foot of water in the basement. And so when they're taking these 13 samples, the concrete, some fabric samples, they're all wet. And the first samples are 1 through 11. Those are the first samples that are sent to the ATF laboratory for chemical analysis. The first analysis by an ATF chemist named William Kennard, he says negative for any traces of accelerant. That's his first report. And we know that through discovery and through some handwritten notes that William Kennard said everything is negative. They then send two additional samples, 12 and 13. And then somehow Mr. Kennard's original report is amended and he eventually says that exhibit 6 and 13 are positive for trace amounts of gasoline. And in his testimony, he never reveals that his original analysis is exculpatory to Greg and actually said that there was no trace amounts of any accelerant, including gasoline. And then another thing is there was a lawnmower in the basement right next to this alleged pile of laundry with a gas can. That's where the family stored their lawnmower. And so if there were trace amounts of gasoline, which John Lentini completely refutes, having gone back and looked at those chromatographs, then it would have had a logical explanation.
And John Lentini is a legendary fire scientist, an actual scientist who started off as an arson investigator. He was a true believer in the old way of thinking, but he's become such an asset for exposing this junk science for what it is, junk, unlike his counterpart here, William Kennard, the same quote-unquote expert from Christine Bunch's case, and so many others. We'll have her story linked as well. So back to the immediate aftermath. With this report from Kennard, the investigators developed a theory that you and your mom plotted to burn down your own house, destroy all of your possessions, put your whole family in danger, grave danger, and then out on the street, including two toddlers, no less, in the middle of a Pittsburgh winter. Right. And all of this to collect on a $20,000 insurance policy, which I'm guessing wouldn't cover the replacement costs of what you lost.
Even at a preliminary hearing, one of the investigators outright said that they're from Homewood, Brushes, and it's a depressed area. We don't believe they had over $20,000 worth of stuff in the house.
So what are we supposed to believe? That you had $17,950 worth of stuff in there or something, and that this was for $2,000, this great scheme? I mean, come on, this is so, it's so sick.
And it's important. I know me and my mother were black and the firemen were white. And I know for a fact there's been other cases in Pittsburgh, Allegheny County alone, where firefighters have died and so-called the suspects were white and they didn't charge them. So I definitely believe race played a major factor in it. You know, we're going to get to the bottom of it. We'll get these guys, this black family out of here.
So you and your family were under investigation and out of a home. Where'd you go? Where did you live?
Ironically, I moved up the street, like two streets above from this house where you could look down with my father and my stepmother. And so I would walk past the house. They had a house just surrounded with agents. They had it airtight. They had it guarded like the White House. And it was on the news so much. Had me thinking, well, is anybody after me and my family? So, you know, I'm like, do I need protection? Do I need to carry a gun? I don't know what's going on.
I mean, with nightly media coverage, it's not crazy to think that a target had been painted on your back. But the investigation wasn't keeping up with the court of public opinion. There was a reasonable explanation for the alleged presence of gasoline in Kennard's report, so they needed more to go on. And a year after the fire, the ATF started offering reward money, $15,000 for information.
It was on the noon news, it was on the 5 o'clock news, and it was on the 6 o'clock news, this press conference issuing and publicizing this reward.
Which sounds like a good idea on paper, but it comes with the obvious pitfall of attracting false information. And sure enough, one of your neighbors, Keith Wright, took the bait.
12 minutes after the 6 o'clock news, Keith Wright walked down to his local fire department and made a statement. A year after the fire, having never made a statement before, saying that he saw Greg standing outside of his family's home before fire personnel got on scene. Very damaging to Greg, because as you know, he and his mother have always said, we arrived after fire personnel were on scene. We were at the Giant Eagle shopping. And so that put a hole in Greg's alibi.
But this hole in the alibi was not quite enough to get a warrant, so they kept going with this strategy.
One of my friends told me that. He said, hey, man, you know, the ATF came to visit me down in South Carolina, and they offered me $4,000. And they said, just say that his mother made him do it for insurance money. And I was like, what? He said, yeah, man.
So it appears that they didn't care if the information was false or not. But your friend from South Carolina, Raul Gibson, stood strong. So the ATF found another taker, which came about when you had actually followed through on getting a gun.
I did end up getting in trouble with a gun. You know, I had it for safety.
The summer of 1995, he gets in trouble for the first time as a juvenile. And while, you know, possession of a gun is a serious juvenile offense, it's the first time he's ever been in front of the juvenile court. And instead of probation or house arrest, some type of like check-in program, community-based program, Greg is sent to Vision Quest in Franklin, Pennsylvania, which is like a wilderness slash boot camp program. So one of the Pittsburgh homicide detectives tells ATF, and then ATF immediately goes to the Vision Quest program and asks for all of Greg's bunk mates and starts to reach out to 15, 16, 17-year-olds and asking whether Greg has made any inculpatory statements or has he mentioned this or confessed to anybody. And no one is making a statement. And so they start to reach out to probation officers for each one of these kids. And the 15-year-old in particular that does eventually end up testifying against Greg, his probation officer is contacted upwards of 20 times. Each and every time, money is brought up by the ATF and the fact that there is a reward in exchange for testimony implicating Greg. And finally, they have a face-to-face with 15-year-old Ibrahim Abdullah, who only after he is told that there is a $15,000 reward, if he has information that would implicate Greg, does he make a statement. And the probation officer notes that he was really concerned about the statement, particularly because it is yes and no answers to all leading questions. And so, did Greg Brown tell you something about this fire? Yes, sir. Did he tell you that he started the fire? Yes, sir. And so the 15-year-old's not offering any facts, any new facts, any corroborating facts. He's simply answering these very leading questions from the ATF.
Nevertheless, this 15-year-old, Ibrahim Abdullah, gave them what they need to make arrests. You were charged with arson and murder, and your mother, Darlene Buckner, was charged with arson, murder, conspiracy, and insurance fraud.
I just thought I got arrested. And then when I called home and my aunt answered the phone, she said, they got your mom too. I said, what? You already know you didn't do anything. Now they're arresting your mother. Basically, they had a person saying, I killed three firemen, but I'm bragging about it. You know, they want you to believe it. And I was bragging about it like it was a cool crime. I mean, name one rap song where rappers was bragging about setting fires or a movie, anything. That's not a cool crime. It's crazy, man.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox? There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
As he's preparing for testimony, 15-year-old Ibrahim Abdullah starts to get cold feet. And he tells the ATF agent, I don't think I want to do this. I want to back out. I don't think I want to testify. And the ATF agent puts him in a room with the surviving members of the firefighters who really, you know, impose upon him how important it is to them that justice be served and what a good thing he's doing. And so not only does this 15-year-old have the motivation of $15,000 and what it could do for his family, and then he also has the pressure of the ATF and the hopes of the victims' families on him.
So this kid, Ibrahim, his cold feet seem to have gotten nice and toasty all of a sudden.
And we got to give this guy's proper credit, Jason Wick from the ATF.
He definitely was persistent, even when he was receiving no information from these children. He was not afraid to use that financial incentive to get the statement that he wanted.
And I read that later on, as a man, Ibrahim admitted that it went even deeper than that for him with this ATF agent, Jason Wick.
Yeah, he later testifies that he was kind of smitten with the ATF agent. The ATF agent, you know, helped him with like court costs, helped him with some restitution in his other cases, helped him obtain his birth certificate, would take him on these like rides in his car and would like speed, would swear, would tell him how powerful he is as an ATF agent. And he said, you know, I thought this guy was cool. I thought he was really cool.
So this kid, Ibrahim, was charmed and incentivized, to say the least, as was the neighbor, Keith Wright. And they came to testify against you and your mom, who are on trial together. Oof, it hurts my heart to even say that. And despite these press conferences, your attorney, Al Lindsay, was somehow unaware of the reward money. Nevertheless, the jury nearly found out about this paid testimony scheme anyway.
During trial, Greg told you about his friend from South Carolina named Raul Gibson. Raul Gibson testified at trial for the defense, saying, ATF came to visit me in South Carolina, and Agent Wick told me that if I gave an inculpatory statement against Greg, I would be paid $7,000. And at trial, one of the prosecutors, the federal prosecutor who was cross-examining him, said, Raul, do you think that there's just some fund somewhere that agents can go and grab you $7,000? And Raul, a kid at the time, was like, I don't know about that. And then in closing arguments, you know, prosecutors really made it seem like it was preposterous that they would be paying witnesses.
Even though they most definitely were and had been saying so on the news, yet Greg's attorney was somehow unaware. But even so, did he try to bring up what Raul Gibson said when cross-examining Ibrahim Abdullah?
They talked about what his motivation for testifying would be. And what he testified to was that he talked it over with his mom, and his mom said it was the right thing to do. For a defense attorney, you can't cross that, especially for a 15-year-old kid who you're very much trying to be like use kid gloves with and not look like a jerk in front of the jury. When the 15-year-old says, I talked to my mom and she said it was the right thing to do, there's nowhere to go from there.
So the state successfully passed off these paid witnesses as concerned citizens, followed by this quote-unquote arson expert, William Kennard, who, unbeknownst to the jury, judge, and defense, had changed his original report to reflect the presence of gasoline in 2 of 13 samples. And even though you were contending with an outright lie, there was still the reasonable explanation of the gas-powered lawnmower stored in the basement. A defense expert could have and should have gone a long way to combat this had your defense attorney even bothered. But he didn't. Now, after seeing all this go down, did you still hold out hope that the jury would get it right?
To be honest, part of me did. The bailiff grabs the verdict from the jury foreman and he hands it to the judge. The judge was, he was definitely refereeing for them the whole time. You know, every rule, I mean, we didn't get any type of calls if this would be a game. And I seen the judge's face. He had a confused look on his face when he read the verdict to himself. And his facial expression was like, what the hell is this? And I was like, maybe I got a chance. So he read the verdict, and my mother was getting acquitted of everything. I'm like, whoa, did we do this? And then when they got to the very last charge on my mother, they found her guilty of insurance fraud. So I said, okay, now they're going to get me. And sure enough, they found me guilty on everything, except they acquitted us of conspiracy, which absolutely made no sense. Because if she's the mastermind and she made her son do it, that's obviously a conspiracy.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
I might have been up there a month, and I called home one day and my uncle answered the phone and he said, you're going to court. Something about a jury misconduct. You know, during the trial, they tell the jury, don't talk to your family members, don't read any papers, don't listen to the news, don't discuss the case with anybody, don't visit the crime scene. So what had happened was a juror had signed an affidavit after I got found guilty, and he was stating how one of the jurors had her daughter at the trial every day and was sitting with the fireman's family, and she visited the crime scene. So I should have got a new trial based off of that, you know. But when I went to the hearing in front of Judge Chacon, he said, well, it doesn't matter. And so that dream was shattered. So, yeah, I'm just a kid, and I get sent to Graterford Prison, the biggest prison in the state at the time. Man, it was rough. It was rough in there. Then, you know, and I pretty much depended on my lawyer, Al Lindsay, my trial lawyer, to get me out.
And not too long after trial, Mr. Lindsay, while litigating that juror misconduct issue and seeking a retrial, he discovered the paid witness scheme.
Yeah. And it came to light during a discovery for Greg's retrial that reward was offered 1 year to the date of the fire. His attorney asks the court to reopen the evidence to tell the jury about the fact that this reward was offered and that it, you know, certainly could be known and expected by these two witnesses. And he's not allowed to do this. So the jury is never told that there is a $15,000 reward. And then, so Greg does his direct appeal, you know, here in Pennsylvania, he does his federal habeas corpus, and each and every time members of the prosecution team say no witnesses were paid. There is no evidence that witnesses were paid.
Even though Raul Gibson had testified about being offered a reward at the original trial. So this issue became central to your post-conviction efforts, but only after the journalism students at Point Park University's Innocence Institute, under the guidance of Bill Mushi, they were able to develop the evidence to prove what had happened with these witnesses.
They got in touch with Ibrahim Abdullah, and he acknowledged that he got paid, and the neighbor, Keith Wright. You know, it's like the summer of 2010, right after the two witnesses acknowledged that they did receive some type of benefits. we had got in touch with Gerald Hurst. He was a great arson expert in Texas. He wrote back and agreed that it didn't look like it was arson to him. I got back in court. I won my appeal rights, and Judge Williams agreed to give me a hearing based off of I didn't have a proper expert witness at my trial. After that, Mr. Mushi said, I'm just a professor. He says, you're going to need representation. We're not lawyers. And it just so happened also in the summer of 2010 that Temple started their Innocent Project, and he got in touch with Marissa Bluestein.
The Pennsylvania Innocence Project picked up your case in the lead up to this hearing in front of Judge Williams, while Bill Mushi's team continued to gather evidence.
Bill Mushi and his students, they did several FOIA requests. And one of the documents that they got from the ATF were these two redacted checks.
A check for $10,000, a check for $5,000, and it was blacked out.
And so really all they could tell was that the ATF issued two checks, one for $5,000, one for $10,000. They couldn't tell who they had gone to. And so they went back and they looked at all of the appellate history in Greg's case, and they were confused, right? Because prosecutors really made it seem like it was preposterous that they would be paying witnesses. And so finally, in 2010, when these redacted checks are obtained by the Innocence Institute in Point Park, they go back and they say to the Allegheny County District Attorney's Office, okay, if no witnesses were paid, what are these?
When Mr. Mushi confronted them, David Hickton was in charge of the ATF at the time. He responded, oh, well, they got paid, but they weren't expecting anything. We didn't make any promises beforehand. You know, we basically paid them out the clear blue.
Oh, yeah, that's a good story. I got a nice bridge outside of Pittsburgh. I want to
right.
see it around there too. That's great.
And so Point Park investigators find Ibrahim Abdullah, who is now, you know, in his late 20s. And they ask him, when were you paid? And did you know you were going to be paid at the time of your testimony? And he very freely said, yes, I was a 15-year-old kid. They offered me $15,000. It was more money than I had ever seen in my life, and it was highly motivating. I knew before trial, and actually, I expected the $15,000. I was disappointed to get only five.
Okay, so that solves the mystery of whose name was on each redacted check. $5,000 for Ibrahim and $10,000. For Keith Wright.
Point Park was having a really difficult time locating Keith Wright. And so the Pennsylvania Innocence Project then got Dave Fawcett involved from Reed Smith. And Dave was actually able to locate Keith Wright. Mr. Wright also said, yes, I absolutely knew about the reward. I knew about it before trial. Then we were able to bring in Keith Wright, bring in Ibrahim Abdullah at the post-conviction hearing and testify about not only their knowledge prior to trial, but that promises were made to them. And then Ibrahim Abdullah, the 15-year-old kid at the time, further testified that Jason Wick told him prior to his testimony, they're going to ask you if I've promised you anything, if there's any kind of incentive or reward. And I want to be very clear, I didn't promise you anything. Do you understand?
Right. So the prosecution is saying to this 15-year-old kid,
lie.
We want you to lie. And we want to make sure, wink, wink, you're going to lie about the lie, right?
So it's like, there's a veiled threat of there's this money on the line, right? So lie well.
So both paid witnesses exposed the scheme in front of Judge Williams in 2012. And then the ATF agent, Jason Wick, he was also at this hearing.
He threatened Dave Fawcett in the hallway. He threatened Dave and said, you're trying to ruin my fucking name. You know, excuse my language. You're trying to ruin my name. You know, Dave said, he just threatened me in the hallway when he's on the stand like a perfect gentleman. You know, and of course, he denied ever paying any witness anything or offering anybody anything.
Dave Fawcett also presented a few other witnesses that lent credibility to Abdullah and Wright's recantation. So things must have been looking up.
Dave said, man, I never seen nothing like this. He said everything went perfect for us these 3 days, you know, and then I might have waited for my answer for 2 years.
Yeah, you did.
Right. And then
January 2012 is a hearing, and then February 2014 right. is the relief.
Then 2014, I was in the courtroom and Judge Williams said, Mr. Brown, your attorneys made good points. The prosecutors made good points, too. And my heart started beating. But Mr. Brown, I believe your witnesses. You asked for a new trial. I'm going to give you a new trial. I couldn't hear nothing but my heart beating. And I just remember giving my brother, my youngest brother, Durante, because they both were babies, but he was a newborn when all this happened. And I gave him a head nod, man. That was the best day right there. Well, second best day, because obviously the day I got out was the best day. And I stayed down there for 2 years, down the county, from 2014 to 2016. I had a bail that was ridiculously high. The district attorney appealed immediately. And when they lost their last appeal, they tried to go back to the old playbook, tried to get people that was on a pod with me to, you know, jailhouse informants. They went to all my cellmates through 20 years that they could find. Fortunately for me, those guys stood firm and didn't lie on me.
So they had one final play. With the ATF involved, this case was always under joint federal and state jurisdiction. But with Judge Williams on this case, their options in state court were finally running out.
And so this dual prosecution, this state and federal prosecution, once again got together and said, okay, we don't want to go into trial in front of Judge Williams. We can't get him to recuse. And so we'll drop state charges. We'll switch forums and we'll take Greg up the street to the federal court. They asked to withdraw state charges. Judge Williams, when he granted the nol pros motion, the motion to withdraw, he did do it with prejudice, meaning that, you know, if they lost in federal court, they couldn't come immediately back to state court and prosecute Greg. And then we got to federal court and argued for supervised release.
I was released a week before Thanksgiving of 2016. It was bittersweet, man, because I was obviously happy to come home, but I had to live 4 or 5 years with this case hanging over my head.
You know, the one thing that stands out, obviously, Greg walking out of the Allegheny County Jail, we're standing in the lobby. First thing he says to the journalists who are asking him questions is, I want to thank the firefighters for saving my family. That's the first thing that's on his mind the moment he's walking out of being wrongly incarcerated for 20 years.
That's beautiful, Greg. So now you're released, but still not totally free. You still had this case hanging over your head.
I was pretty much free with the exception of I couldn't leave Western Pennsylvania or out the state without permission. So it was basically like me getting this charge from the beginning, but making bond.
And this dragged out for about 6 long years, right? And this time you did not have Judge Williams.
The players on this case in 1997 are Prosecutor Mark Clark, Assistant United States Attorney Sean Sweeney, Judge Sircone presiding over the case. When we get to the federal court, we have Sean Sweeney, United States Attorney. He's going to prosecute the case federally. We're initially assigned to Judge Schwab here in the Western District, who recuses himself, and who is the case assigned to, but Judge Sircone, who has been appointed to the federal bench. And so once again, we have a state federal team and the exact same players as 22 years ago.
Who all have a professional interest in maintaining this conviction. So how did it finally get resolved?
I had a meeting with my attorneys. They said the government is offering the Alford plea, right? And my thing was, I'm never going to admit to something I didn't do. And they said, well, this is unique. They're saying the case will be over. And it's, you're pleading guilty while maintaining your innocence at the same time.
It was a hard decision. I remember we presented this to Greg. We're all sitting at Reed Smith. It's still during COVID. So we're sitting out on an outdoor patio. That's what, I don't know, Greg, 13 stories above the city line. Greg is afraid of heights. So he's skirting across the wall, trying to get to his seat. And we just had a very candid conversation about if we go back to trial, we have Judge Sircone, we have Sean Sweeney, we have the exact same players. None of us can labor under any illusions that you could not be wrongfully convicted. Again, we have seen it happen. We have seen it happen with these exact people.
It was hard for me, man. It was very hard for me. And that's what we end up doing in June of 2022. Till this day, man, it bothers me. But I don't know. It's over. I'm glad it's over with. And like Liz told me, she's like, look, there's no restrictions. You'll be able to tell your story. And then Dave said, if we do fight it and get acquitted, there's no guarantee that I will get compensated. So it was tough, man. It's still tough, man. It definitely bothers me.
Right. Even though you had amassed all of this evidence and served all of that time, Plus, the great John Lentini was prepared to testify about Kennard's false report, actually showing no presence at all of gasoline on any of the samples, and that this was actually not an arson case at all. Still, there was no guarantee that you'd get an acquittal. And even if you managed that, there was no guarantee the compensation would be forthcoming.
The most accountability that we can have is telling your listeners what happened to Greg.
And we're very honored to have you. So is there anything at all you'd like to ask of our audience? Anything they can do?
I just want to say I got a book coming out, The Greg Brown Story, Volume 1. I'm almost done with it. I just want to ask the audience, man, you know, just use a little bit of common sense. You just can't take everything they say as gold. You can't be that naive when someone's life is in your hands.
Amen. And we'll keep our ears to the ground about your book, as well as link the Pennsylvania Innocence Project in the episode description so people can show some support. Without them and other organizations like them, folks like Greg would have it even harder. And with that, let's go to my favorite part of the show. Closing arguments, of course, is the part of the show where I have the honor of thanking each of you. And now I'm just going to kick back in my chair, turn my microphone off, close my eyes, and leave my headphones on. And then, Liz, you have the microphone to say whatever has been left unsaid, and then just hand it off to Greg.
So, you know, experts theorize that anywhere from 3 to 10% of all people convicted in the United States annually are actually innocent. I think that's probably very conservative. But even if we are very conservative and say that it's only 1%, that's like more than 10,000 people a year who are convicted of a crime that they didn't commit. Innocence organizations like mine are underfunded, we're understaffed, we're very small nonprofit organizations. And so it takes us years to investigate and then to litigate a wrongful conviction. And so when you do see that exoneration in the news, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful day. It has been years in the making. If we can prevent wrongful convictions from happening, if we can be better jurors, better prosecutors, better defense attorneys, better judges, then we won't cost people and their families literal decades of their life in prison. And so be skeptical, be healthily skeptical of what you're hearing, and don't just take, you know, someone who is very confident and also can be very wrong word for it.
Yeah, that family members, neighbors, you know, everyone needs to hear these type of stories because, you know, everyone might not listen to this. So no one wants to get involved or care until it's their cousin, their son, their brother, their nephew. You have to pay attention beforehand because you have a responsibility. Because if you're not helping out beforehand, then it's too late. And then when it's your loved one, they get charged and then you're crying. You should have did something about it, you know. You see a face on TV or in the paper, it's kind of hard. You know, the average person that never had a loved one to deal with this or a friend, oh, he's guilty. Look what he did. You know, you shouldn't judge because you never know when it will be you and your family out the front row begging and pleading these judges. When you get to the point where you need the Innocence Project, it's bad anyway because that means obviously it didn't work out at court. So people just need to just share these type of stories as much as possible. The last thing I want to say, I got extremely blessed and lucky at the same time. Things just came together for me at the right time. I could still be in there trying to reach out to different organizations. You know, it's messed up what happened to me, but I wouldn't want another kid to go through this or no other family. So that's it.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Kleiber. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
There's two kinds of people in the world. People who love Health Aid Kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.